In Luke 15, verses 1 and 2, and then jump to verse 11. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable.
There was a man who had two sons. The younger son said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So the man divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came back to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father. I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. When he was still a long way off, his father saw him. He was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and he's alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf for him because he's got him back safe and sound.' The older son became angry, and he refused to go in. The father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, 'For all those years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you've never even gave me a young goat so I can celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitute comes back, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, for this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Interesting, isn't it, to listen to someone just recite a passage? You kind of sit there, don't you? You can see it, you can smell it, you know what's going on. And I'll try and not mess with what Sana's just done. So with permission, though, I want to share a real story, a true story with you. The names I'm making up because I didn't hear the names, but the story is true nonetheless. John and Jane had tried for years to have a family, but natural means didn't allow them to do that, and so they applied for, got into the IVF program, and were successful, and they gave birth to a healthy, bouncy boy. All things were going really well. But they were keen to have a family, and so 7 or 8 months into their first child's life, they got back into the IVF program because they wanted to give their son another child, a brother or a sister, not because they were greedy. They just wanted to have a family, a group of people into whom they could invest their lives, and so they began the process again. In preparation for embryo implantation, the doctors supercharged Jane's body with hormones so that it would be hyper-receptive to an embryo that would be planted, so that the embryo would be given the very best chance of success. And with her biology so primed, the specialist looked John and Jane in the eye and said, no intimacy for 5 days before or after the implantation. Apparently the trouble is John and Jane, they love one another and smitten. Anyway, she fell pregnant, much to the joy of them and the whole of their extended family. And so she goes off for the ultrasound. And the technician doing the ultrasound says, congratulations, you have twins. Jane says, that's not possible. There was only one embryo implanted. Oh, yeah, you're right. You've got triplets. So they went from one healthy, bouncy boy to four children, two by IVF, two by natural means, and they've got four kids now under the age of 18 months. Yeah, that's all the parents right there. I can remember the night or two when a child was up in the middle of the night and you're there as like a wrung-out dishcloth trying to deal with one child. What must it be like to deal with four? And what are the changes? It's not like, let's get another capsule for the back seat. You got to get a whole new back seat in a new car with three new capsules. There's more prams, a mountain of nappies to get a hold of, more cots, renovations because you can't leave your children, who you want to love, sleeping in a hallway. And so there's changes to schedules. Everything changes when a family grows like that. And I've no doubt there will be times when John and Jane will look at each other and Jane will look at John and say, don't you even think? And they'll say to one, why have we got this challenge on our hands? And I hope that they grab a cup of tea or coffee, or maybe both, and sit down and say, well, we wanted another brother or sister for our first son. We wanted to grow old together and watch children, our children, go off to school and graduate. Wanted to walk down the aisle with a daughter. We wanted our children to have their own children. That vision captured us. That's why we're willing to pay the price of an expanding family. Well, you know, as a church, we're in this series, Growing Family Checklist, and we've looked at nurture your faith, praying boldly, pray for people, stretch your dollar, where we take our limited resources and go to Jesus and say, do what you will. When a church does those kind of things, it experiences growth. But some might ask a question, but like, why? Why? I mean, this service is full. The car park's a nightmare. You've got little guys in orange costumes and stuff waving you on. I don't want to go where they wave me. I want to park where I want to park. I want to sit where I want to sit. Work is demanding. The week is full. I just want to come here. Who cares about the 100,000 people moving in? There are other churches. Let them take care of them. I have needs and I want them met. The man or the woman who looked at you from the mirror this morning will have an answer to begin to answer those questions. The man or the woman in the mirror will say to you, look at your story this far. Remember how Jesus reached out to you some time back. Look at Jesus, look at his vision, and let that capture your heart again. And the best way to be captured is to sit with or to meditate on the vision of God. And there are numerous, multiple examples of God's vision all the way from Genesis through to the last chapter of the Bible in the book of Revelation. Sit with the vision expressions, the man or the woman in the mirror would say, and let them warm your heart again. One of the best places to go for this is that passage that Sana so delightfully recited to us in Luke chapter 15. So, if you've got your Bible, open it up to that, unless you are like Sana and can remember it off by heart. Luke chapter 15, and let's look at verse 20. That's where we'll start, where we read this. The father, filled with compassion, runs to his son, throws his arms around him and kisses him. At first, it looks like a Hallmark card ad, you know, the string music playing. We're at some airport. The kids come through international space from an overseas adventure. The kid had left on good terms, is returning on good terms. He's kept in touch. That's what it looks like at first. But we could not be further from the truth of a Hallmark ad right here. This scene is a stunning display of grace and mercy by a father who had been callously rejected by his son. Come back to chapter 15 and verse 12. The younger son says to his dad, "Give me my share of the estate." Translated into 21st century language, "Drop dead, give me the money now. I can't wait for you to drop dead. I want my inheritance now." And then we're told in verse 13 that this son gathered everything he had, including the capital, including the property that his father gave him. He had a fire sale, is what's implied here. Sold it all and then goes to a far country and we're told squanders his wealth in wild living, whatever that means. Yeah, it's a bit like a story I heard only this last week or two. You may have read about it in the papers. Where a woman was found dead in her house in Kellyville, mummified. Anyone, does it ring a bell to anybody? A few people read this story. Some woman had passed away. Apparently, it seems, because of the state of condition of her body, she was 6 months dead in her house, left there by her daughter. The coroner wept over this case and criticized three daughters for not planning appropriate care for their 83-year-old mother, and she was particularly scathing that they had left the care of this old, demented, this woman suffering from dementia in the hands of the alcoholic daughter who has been charged with fraud for using her mother's account and spending everything that her mother had while her mother lay dead and was mummifying in the home. The scandal of all of that, and that it took place in our neighborhood, cannot help but leave us with revile and disgust. How could such a thing take place? That is what the younger son was doing to the father. In the far country, he spends everything. There was a severe famine, Jesus goes on in his story. The whole country's in need. The young man's got no money, no food. So he goes and hires himself out to a pig farmer. And there he longed to feed himself with the rubbish he was feeding the pigs. But he was unable to do that. And so he comes to his senses, we're told. Now this isn't came to his senses as if to say, I made a mess of my life. I left my poor dad brokenhearted. And I've poured shame all over him, and so I will go back home and I will apologize and set things aright. That's not what it means. Coming to his senses is, I made a mess of my life, and if I go home, the old man might just employ me. There's no sense of I caused him any grief. And so he goes home, we're told, and while he was still a long way off, the father saw him, ran to him, wrapped his arms around him, and kissed him. He ran to him. Old men don't run in any society, it seems to me. There was a time when I used to love to run and feel the wind in my face. I don't want to run anymore. Young men run. In the first century, old men in particular would not run, for it meant bearing their legs, and an old man would never bear his legs in public, for that would just bring shame upon him. But he lifts up his robe, bears his legs, and he runs to his son. And then he puts his arm around his son who wished him dead and kisses him, when the son ought to have been on his knees kissing his father's feet. The old man does this to protect the son from the village who would have liked to have beaten the son for the shame that he'd poured upon the father and the village. And yet this old man, his father, with no sense of retribution, embraces his son. It's an act of pure, unadulterated grace which says to the son, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, there is a place to call home. Welcome home. And the father does that, even though the son has not yet repented. But when the father does all of this, that's when the young man's heart is broken. You kind of catch it in verse 21. Then the son says, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. It's almost an exact repeat of what he'd been rehearsing in the pigsty, except there's no sense of give me a job in here. He sees how he's been welcomed. His heart is broken, and now he knows he is not worthy to be called a son. But grace has its effect. We read on and we're told that the father says, quick, bring the best robe, put it on this boy, put a ring on his finger, put sandals on his feet, bring the fattened calf. Don't worry about a sheep or a goat, bring the fattened calf. Invite the whole village, because this son of mine was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found, and they began to celebrate. He was lost and now is found. It's a fascinating couple of concepts. Lost. Means to be separated. Over a quarter of a century ago, my wife and I were walking through a brand new shopping centre for us, and I think it was pretty much brand new then. And as we walked, our family was very young. We only had two. We now have three. One was a babe in arms. And so we're walking through the shopping centre, and Robin had Ben in her arms, and we decided that we'd go in different directions, that way and this way, and so, okay, and we'd meet at a certain point. And so we went and did our investigating, and we came back at the agreed time, and I said, what'd you see? And I said to Robin, where's Emma? And my wife said, well, she's with you. And I said, she was with you. And then the blood began to drain from our faces. And because I could still run, I ran all through the shopping centre while Robin did what she could. And we came back together with no Emma. And so I ran through the shopping centre again, calling her name. And I eventually went down a hallway that had not been down in the first run. At the end of it is a horsey ride. And there is our daughter, happy as Larry. Did she think she was lost? No. But I'm her dad, and I knew better, because she was separated from the ones who loved her. Once found, this young man experiences a magnificent feast, a prodigal feast. It's where the father is the prodigal. Prodigal means reckless extravagance. It's not a lamb, it's not a goat, it's a fattened calf for the whole village to come and feast on. And the man or the woman in your mirror would say to you, that is how you were once treated by Jesus.
There was a time when you were separated from Jesus. There was a time when you may have been like Larry, happy as Larry, enjoying the horsey rides of life, but for Jesus, you were lost because you were separated from him, and he put an all-out search on for you. And when he found you, he welcomed you, embraced you, asked you to sit at his table, which is exactly what Jesus was doing at the beginning of Luke 15, which caused the start of this story. Jesus is sitting down and sinners and tax collectors are coming and they're sitting with Jesus. He's welcoming them and he's eating with them. It's kind of like as they take a seat, you know, the hand of God give them a friendly slap on the back. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat. Or delight. They would have experienced the delight in his eyes. I'm so glad. Here, sit. Now, some of us might say, yeah, but like, why does Jesus let them in? Like, really? I've given it all. I've given it everything I had for years. I never squandered my life on prostitutes and drugs, which is really interesting because we don't know if the younger brother had done that until the older brother says that in verse 30. I've served for 5 or 7 or 4 decades. I've slaved in this church. Why don't they throw a party for me? If you've ever thought anything like that, and my name is John Gray, and I have said from time to time, I have slaved for this church, then we ought to take those kind of things as flashing lights on our dashboard and hold our breath as we read on in Jesus' story. He continues, meanwhile, the older son was in the field. And when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing in verse 26. So he called one of the servants and asked him, what's going on? And the brother, he said, your brother's come and your father's killed the fattened calf because he's come back safe and sound. And the older brother became angry and refused to go in. You kind of hear the older brother asking the questions that we may have asked, that I have asked. You can hear them in verse 29 and 30 where the older brother says to the dad, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. And now it's the older brother causing grief. Like the younger brother, the older brother is self-obsessed and has a complete lack of regard or respect for his father. He causes him grief, humiliating him and shaming him in public by refusing to go in to a very public feast. Like the younger brother, the older brother is lost. But with the same concern for the younger brother, the father leaves the feast and goes out to the older brother and begs with him to come in and says in verse 31, my son, which is a very tender word in the original language at this point, my son. He gently reminds the son that the father has always loved him and that everything he has is your son's. He could have taken a goat at any time and partied. It's all yours. So the protestations of the older brother are like flashing lights that say, here is a heart in need of grace. And the father offers it to him. And that is a thinly veiled cover for what Jesus is offering the Pharisees at the beginning of Luke 15. Where they are off grumbling while Jesus is over and welcoming sinners and tax collectors. Why does he do that? We have slaved for God. And in the midst of all of that, Jesus puts his hand out and says, but I have always loved you. And I would welcome you at my table. And so as to the younger brother, so to the older brother, Jesus says, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, there is a place to call home. Come, he says. And that is why there's no better way to paint a picture of what it means to be saved than to have a banquet. Because the sights and the aromas of the roasting meat is only surpassed by its taste. To see a full beast roasting over an open fire, to smell its aromas and to see the juices drawing out and dropping into the fire and to see it flare up only draws you to stand around. And then you get the food and it's put on a plate and it's so succulent and so well cooked, it falls apart on your plate. It's accompanied by vegetables which are rich and exotic, and there are sauces and gravies to use that are so spice infused, when you put them in your mouth, they have a party on your tongue. To sit at a table is like that is to know warm hospitality. It's to sit in a community which is grace-filled, it's to be delight-filled, it's pure festive joy. And that strong, delectable image lies behind the psalmist's words in Psalm 34, which say, "Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man. Blessed is the woman who takes refuge in him." And that is the experience of anyone, younger brother, older brother, who has tasted God's grace firsthand. You know the relief of guilt lifted when we've confessed our sins. You know the comfort the shepherd brings. You know the refuge in time of trouble. And so when we sit with and meditate upon any of the expressions of God's vision from Genesis through to Revelation, we see his vision afresh, and when we let it capture us a little more, can we not then reach out to others? Like the woman who squandered her mother's money while her mother mummified at Kellyville. You know, friends, I love living in the hills, and I've loved what the hills has afforded my family. I don't even mind hanging out with you. But there are days when my heart is nearly undone because of what I see and hear of and read of in the hills. I buried a teenager whose parents in this building, I buried a teenager whose parents cared little for what their kid did. And that 15-year-old overdosed at a party. The funeral was strange. Few cried. And I cannot recall either parent shedding a tear. But they lived in a $2 million house. I've spoken with men and women who have been beaten and abused by their partner, and whose children are on ice, and whose adult life has been one nightmare. I hear of people indignant of the mummified woman's story, and yet seem to be oblivious to the damage their gambling or alcohol consumption is having on their children. If you listen to our 421 podcast, then the next one, which is released today, you will hear staggering statistics of people drawn into online pornography to satiate their desires. 30% of addicts are women. 70% are men. A boy has first experience of pornography at the age of 10 on average. 100% of 15-year-old boys have seen graphic, violent pornography on their devices. As I talk to some people, they say to me, life is not too flash, and I wish that I could die in my sleep. Others are like my 3-year-old when she was 3, happy as Larry, distracted on the horsey rides of life. Can we not show them a different fare upon which to feast? Can't we introduce them to Jesus and say, taste and see that the Lord, he is good? Whenever we go, wherever we go this week, after this service, until we meet again next week, whether your work is in an office, at a school, do you trade in some people's homes or a commercial premises, whether you go to school, a university or TAFE, whether you do sport or in a club like Probus or Rotary, the Men's Shed or a book club, wherever we go, can we not let people know of Christ and His grace of such measure that says to them, no matter what you have done, no matter what you've become, there is a place to call home. And when people see the difference that Christ makes in us, so that we are no longer the young brother or the older brother, but we are like Jesus, when they see that and they hear the message of Jesus, they become like the merchant looking for fine pearls, Jesus said. When they find it, they go away, sell everything they have in order to possess this one thing. Another preacher said, if you're a singer, it will make you want to sing the hallelujah chorus. If you're a dancer, it will make you want to dance. If you're an Anglican, it will make you almost want to dance. This vision explains the why behind our church. It fuels our mission. That's why we look for more growth. That's why we're wanting to see more people come. And so today we're asking you, will you join us? Will you invest your time, your talents, and your treasures in helping us draw people to the feast? Will you help us do that? Someone drew you in. Will you return the favor to someone else? And that's why we gave you these forms. And there was some delightful someone's daughter delightfully handing these out to everybody who came. And I didn't see anybody refuse. How can you refuse a delightful young girl? You have your forms. Will you bring them? Because there are far more people in the hills who are lost than are found. I guess we could ask, well, will it really make a difference? It's a question that a young woman might have asked herself 250 years ago. But if she did, it seems like it was only a momentary question. She's largely unknown, but I hope that she will become a heroine, particularly to young women in our day. Her story is magnificently revealed in a book called Fierce Convictions. It's the biography of Hannah Moore. Hannah was a poet, a reformer, abolitionist, who was so captured by Christ and His vision of His feast, she relentlessly, tirelessly, proactively worked for the complete reform of her age, not just her country. Her aim was to alleviate suffering and oppression in the lower classes, reform the exclusive and belligerent behavior of the upper classes. She advanced Christianity at home and throughout the world. She worked alongside William Wilberforce as a tireless crusader for the abolition of slavery. She wrote hundreds of pamphlets to persuade England to abolish slavery. She refused to buy sugar from the West India country, West India sugar fields, because she said that sugar had blood on it, the blood of slaves. She gave up her time, her talents, and her enormous treasure so that Sunday schools could be established, not like what we're running right now, but schools in which children could be educated, because Sunday was the only day when children were freed from child slave labor in the Industrial Revolution. Not only did she abolish slavery, not only were children educated, but the upper class began to have a social conscience. England began to come to Christ. And she was instrumental in taking the gospel to the world and had a substantial hand in the establishment of the Church Mission Society. She did not work alone. She worked with William Wilberforce and others, of course. But she and they were captured by Christ and His vision. And they brought massive change in their lifetime to the world in which they lived. So much so that Eric Metaxas, who wrote the foreword to Fierce Convictions, said, if our generation could deliver one or more Hannah Moores, we might see our own reformation. So, if you want to know how to change the world to God's glory, get captured by Christ, captured by His vision, read Fierce Convictions, and go do likewise.
This is the moment. This is the day.